need a boost to get through another crazy holiday season? Get the energy you need and fight seasonal fatigue with NT Factor's holiday sale. From now through January 1st, get 20% off either size of NT Factor Lipids powder and get a 30-count bottle of patented energy with NT Factor free. That's a $36 value. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to repair damaged cells and improve your body's natural energy production. Clinical trials have shown that NT Factor's exclusive formula reduces fatigue by almost half and helps reduce some of the unwanted effects of aging. I don't go a day without it, so take advantage of NT Factor's holiday sale and stock up for the new year. Get 20% off NT Factor Lipids powder and receive a 30-count bottle of patented energy with NT Factor free through January 1st. Call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're back after a little bit of a holiday hiatus with another edition of Q&A with Layla. I hope you all had very enjoyable holidays and are ready to imbibe at the font of knowledge when it comes to health. Here we are once again with Q&A with Layla. I'm with Layla Mutin. Hey, Layla, kind of missed you last week. I don't know. I'm getting sort of in the rhythm. I'm in the rhythm of doing these every week. And yes. I really enjoy doing them. And, you know, so we took a little, we took a hiatus for the holidays, but glad to be back because it's always fun.
Yeah, it is fun. Good to be back. I can't believe it's December.
I know. It's really strange.
Oh, my goodness.
It is
so
really
one holiday down, two to go.
Okay. Yeah, I do a little retrospective at the end of the year, you know, the top 10 podcasts of the year. And I look at some of the podcasts that I did in 2024, and it seems like I did them, you know, ages ago, but they still were within a year. So in some ways, you know, the time really accelerates, but in some ways it just seems like so much has transpired since 2024. You know, we had an election. So, you know, before the election, you know, it was just like, I was thought like, wouldn't it be great to have like a time machine to get to figure out the outcome of the election, to like set the time machine to November 6th? And because we're with all the uncertainty about the election, and now, you know, it's a foregone conclusion. You know, it's just like, it's all over. So,
you know, lots of movies and series about time travel out there now that you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, would that we could. All right. So, before we get to questions, I just was wondering what I was going to talk about today. And I just, I was like, I had some ideas about some things. And then I just, about 15 minutes before this, recording this podcast, I came across a fascinating article. And it has to do with the impact of foods on our blood sugar. So we know that one of the ways to determine that is with something called the GI, the glycemic index, right? And, you know, we were schooled in the glycemic index. There was a list of things. And I think the index for 100, for like the standard, was, I believe it was sugar, right?
Maybe a slice of white bread, a white potato. Something like that.
What I mean is, things were rated on a scale of 0 to 100 for their glycemic impact, okay?
Yeah.
And sugar, obviously, being the thing that hits you hardest, fastest, creates the most disruption of your blood sugar. And then things that were also carbohydrates, but were slow-release carbohydrates. So we had this whole concept, and I remember when it was developed about 20 years ago, I actually... lectured on that subject, the GI. And then we had these handbooks and tables where you could look at the GI of the food that you ate. But then there were some problems with that, because certain foods you wouldn't eat very much and it would create a big impact on your blood sugar. And other foods you'd have to eat a lot to have an impact on your blood sugar. So then we adjusted that. We came up with something called the glycemic load. And do you remember the distinction? I always get those confused, glycemic load.
Yes. So the glycemic load, for instance, we look at the glycemic index of, say, a baked potato all by itself. That would register easily near 100, if not 100, right?
Okay, right.
But, you know, we're talking about not eating the fiber in the skin or something like that. Yeah. Okay. But the glycemic load of that potato, however, goes down in relation to what do you put on that potato? Maybe you're putting some butter on it, some sour cream. Maybe you're having a steak with that baked potato. That lowers the glycemic load.
That's the context. The context of your eating.
Food ingredients by themselves.
Right.
We're combining in our meals.
I actually thought that glycemic load didn't take into account the other context of the foods that you eat, but that it had to do with the amount that it was practical to consume. So, for example, I guess carrots have a fairly high glycemic index, but, you know, how many carrots can you actually consume? That's what I thought glycemic load adjusted for.
No. Okay. The glycemic load of the carrots would go down when you butter them.
Okay.
Yeah, no. Cooked and buttered carrots, for example.
Yeah, no, clearly. Yeah. So, already, so what I'm getting at, I'm trying to set the stage for this new thing on the blood sugar impact of foods. Okay, so that, you know, we realized is kind of limited, all right? Because different strokes for different folks. Then we found out, subsequently, through the introduction of the CGM, the continuous glucose monitor, which is, you know, instead of painstakingly sticking your finger, you could determine your individual response to foods. And this was this aha moment where we found that different strokes for different folks. So for example, some people would eat buckwheat, you know, a fairly whole grain, and they would have a pretty, you know, normal blood sugar response. And other people would have this astronomical spike in their blood sugar. They would have reactive hypoglycemia. And thus, they determined that not a good idea for me personally, you know, maybe for another person to eat a lot of buckwheat, for example, just for example, you know, so you could actually methodically using a CGM, you know, a lot of non-diabetics did this because CGMs were originally for diabetics, but then we said, hey, you know, it's a great teachable moment for people to discover their reactions to different foods. And so now CGMs are very popular. A lot of companies are offering CGMs outside of medical insurance for a fee so that you can experiment even if you're non-diabetic. And I recommend it. I think it's actually provides a lot of insight on how you react to foods. There's a new wrinkle to it. And, you know, Layla, this field that we've entered, you know, it is a very, very perplexing field, isn't it?
It is.
Because
it really is.
The science is evolving. There's so many controversies, and the controversies just keep on rolling in. So here's the new wrinkle to that, is that even if you check your blood sugar, say, to, you know, a standard meal, say, you know, you want to see how are you reacting to oatmeal? You know, maybe you're virtuous, you're having steel-cut oatmeal, and you want to see how you react to it. Your reaction on one day may be different on another day. That's according to a study in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And the headline here is imprecision nutrition. Imprecision nutrition. It's entitled intra-individual, not inter-individual. Inter means between individuals. Intra, within the individual. Variability of glucose responses to duplicate presented meals in adults without diabetes. And what they found is there was some correlation, you know, from meal to meal, but it was a weak to moderate correlation in terms of what's called the area under the curve, which is how, you know, how blood sugar gets depicted on a graph after a meal challenge. Wow. Isn't that mind-blowing?
It goes to show you that, you know, the attempt of this is to measure a food impact, like it's the only food and it's within a vacuum. But there are so many other variables. What did you eat previously? not only what did you eat and what were your macros.
This is called the second meal effect, right? Because we know that breakfast is important because it influences your blood sugar response to subsequent meals, right?
Right, right. And not only that, how long ago did you eat that meal? But beyond that, how well did you sleep last night? Because we know for a fact that has an adverse impact on blood sugar. You will often get a higher or more unstable blood sugar if you got a poor night's sleep.
Right.
What did you eat the meal the night before? Was there alcohol? Was there dessert? What kind of a mood are you in today?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you hot? Are you cold? There's all kinds of things.
Well, you know, I'll add
the fold or an infection.
I'll add one more thing is that we as humans have circadian rhythms. We also have seasonal rhythms. Time of day is a very important variable. So I wonder in the study, you know, in the study setting, did they have the subjects come in at 10 o'clock in the morning? And then they said, oh, come back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and we'll check you. You know, there's a temporal influence on blood sugar regulation. So, but you know, look, I know this is that on certain days we feel good and some of the other days we don't feel so great.
Right.
You know, it's like we feel tired, you know, we feel run down for inexplicable reasons, not, you know, anything that we can put our finger on.
Yeah. And what else is, if they say measured them at 10 a.m. as you were describing, and they told people to come back at 2, well, who did what between then and 2? Did somebody go for a very long walk? Did somebody sit and do nothing, maybe?
Yep.
Did the third person run? I mean, there's all kinds of impacts. If you went for a long walk, that's going to impact your blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So how do we know?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And everybody now with the wearables, including the continuous glucose monitor, there are more people that I'm seeing in my practice, non-diabetics, who are using this as a tool. And they're really coming away with some very, very valuable information. And it's really gratifying to go through the charts and the graphs of, see what happened? Oh, yeah, that was Super Bowl Sunday.
Yep.
Look what happened to your blood sugar, you know, that kind of a thing.
So the take-home message is not to abandon the use of the CGMs. I think it can provide insights. It's a teachable moment. But don't take the results too literally because, under different circumstances, you may act differently to different foods. Here's another element to that. And this is actually, there's a company called Day 2, which is based on Israeli research that shows that the composition of the microbiome influences the way that people interpret foods vis-a-vis blood sugar responses. So they have actually done AI machine learning to relate the presence of certain bacterial species to the impact of certain foods. Now, I don't know how reliable that is even, but there's some people who swear by it. They say, you know, when they gave me the list of foods that I would have a real blood sugar spike to, it really corresponded to my true reactions. And this is based on not a CGM, it's based on a stool sample.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
So anyway.
So.
I don't know. Do you want to turn in your credentials? I mean, maybe we could have picked something easier like nuclear physics or something like that. Something more straightforward.
Right. For brain surgery, rocket science.
Yeah.
Or are they calling now, you know, rocket surgery.
Rocket surgery, exactly.
Combination of the two, right?
Yeah.
No, this is challenging. It's challenging, but you know, I find at the same time, it's just fascinating.
Yeah. And it's also an opportunity for me personally, and certainly for you, because we have a passion for this, for lifelong learning, and also to correct some of our misapprehensions, you know, some of our mistaken beliefs and modify them, because that, I think, is in the true spirit of science and inquiry.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, like I always say, at the end of the day, I have more questions than answers.
Right.
And so it goes.
All right. But
and
folks,
that's why, you know, we do continuing education. Yeah. Wait,
folks, don't give up. Don't give up. We are reaching a broad consensus about many things. Okay, great. All right, let's get to questions. Speaking of broad consensus. Oh, by the way, maybe before we get to questions, let's take care of some of our important business and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share an important message with you. So how does that sound? Here goes.
Sounds good.
You've heard me talk for years about the breakthrough health benefits of CBD. Now, our friends at CV Sciences have developed an innovative suite of non-CBD products that mimic CBD's healthful effects. CV Sciences' new Plus Health CBD-free line of gummies and capsules. The Plus Health Clarity gummies are packed with DMAE, lion's mane, and rhodiola designed to boost your cognitive performance, enhance memory, and provide natural energy. You need a little peace and calm? Plus Health's Peace Gummies, soothing blend of L-theanine, lemon balm, and St. John's wort supports serenity and relaxation without the drowsiness. And if you're on a journey towards optimal health, the Reshape capsules are packed with powerful ingredients like berberine and OEA to support metabolic health and help maintain healthy blood sugar levels. For more information and to order, head over to pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman. Use coupon code Hoffman30. For 30% off. That's pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman for the new Plus Health non-CBD collection. All right. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They are what make intelligent medicine continuing free resource to you. And now back to our questions. What do we have, Lulu?
Oh, this is from Joanna. Dr. Hoffman, this is about a recent article you wrote about RFK Jr. She says, excellent synopsis. Thank you. Being the health nut that I am, I adore RFK Jr. I just hope he can accomplish half, if not all, that he's proposing.
Indeed. Yeah. And
that would be amazing.
Yeah. This is in reference for, you know, for those of you who don't know, this is in reference to an article that I wrote for our newsletter. Our newsletter is available to you as a free resource. So just like our podcast, just go to drhoffman.com and you'll be prompted to subscribe to the newsletter. And you'll get it in your inbox every week. And as a follow-up to my discussion of the nomination of RFK Jr. and what it means potentially for intelligent medicine listeners and the things that we hold dear, I did a series, and it's a two-part series because I ended up writing like 3,000 plus words. So I said, break it up into two parts about the other nominees who include Marty McCary.
Yes.
And also, we have a Surgeon General candidate, and we have Jay Bhattacharya, and we have Mehmet Oz, and we have a guy named Weldon for CDC. So that will appear in our newsletter series, and you can find it at gearhoffman.com. And I just want to mention that, you know, regardless of what you think of RFK Jr. and all of his proposals, I think the most controversial of which are his views on vaccines, which I think he's sort of modifying. You know, he's trying to, clean up on aisle three before his confirmation hearings, because I think that's probably the most controversial part of his thrust. Is one of his major proposals is outlined in an op-ed that he wrote after he joined the Trump campaign, is that he wants to really put medical education on notice that they need to include a nutrition component, that doctors should be taught nutrition and functional medicine. And that, I mean, I think has got to be one of his least controversial and I think most widely accepted platforms, is that there's a woeful inadequacy of knowledge among doctors about the impact of nutrition on health. And
that's true.
We need to up our game in that respect. That's actually one of the reasons I'm working with my medical school to provide more opportunities for students there to find pathways to learn more about the impact of nutrition and integrative medicine practices.
And that's at the Albert Einstein School of Medicine, your alma mater?
Yep.
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
And it is woeful also how doctors, really many doctors in mainstream anyway, don't know to refer to a qualified nutritionist as
right.
well.
You know, so that's
they're
a
being
good point.
Underutilized.
That's yeah. a good point, because many doctors may say, hey, you know, guess what? I'm really busy keeping up in my field. There's so many developments. I'm a whatever. I'm a gastroenterologist. And but yes, nutrition plays a huge role in gastroenterology. So at least the doctor should have an understanding of where nutrition might fit in and have yeah. the ability to work with a knowledgeable health practitioner like yourself on virtually every patient, because I can't think of a condition in, there goes a siren in the background, just to know that
yeah.
this is New York.
It's New York.
New York City, right? So that there's got to be some nutritional ramification of virtually every medical specialty.
Yes.
And doctors yeah. should at least know where nutrition fits in. You know, even if they're not going to be sitting down and telling patients, you know, what do I have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Maybe they just, you know, they don't have time or inclination or the knowledge base, because it's a whole specialized field.
Sure. So hopefully more light will be shed on all of that, how food is information, which is a tenet of integrative and functional medicine, nutrition. So I'm excited about the future.
We actually have a course at the Alliance for Natural Health. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, at the American Nutrition Association. I belong to both organizations.
You're busy. You're heading up so many things.
Right. And so at ANA, we have a yeah. course that is not designed to turn doctors into nutritionists, but is designed precisely, as you say, to increase awareness about the role that nutrition may play. And we kind of go through the different systems. Yeah. We go through, you know, virtually everything from dermatology to gastroenterology to cardiology to psychiatry, and explain the role that nutrition might play to increase awareness among currently practicing health practitioners about the potential for nutrition to help them achieve better outcomes for their patients. And so that's a course that's available, very economical course, and, you know, we urge health practitioners to take it. And you can take it online.
Yes.
You don't have to, you know, fly somewhere to sit in a
right.
lecture hall for it.
Yeah, in fact, the course is regularly $49, but as an Intelligent Medicine listener, you could get access to this vital content for just $29. Talk about economical. So you just go to theana.org/Hoffman. That's theana.org/Hoffman, and use coupon code Hoffman29 for the exclusive discount. I think it's great.
Yeah, that's that's a pretty good price to pay for an education, given that mm-hmm. a lot of people are saddled with tens of thousands of dollars of debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
With degrees that, you know, may or may not be remunerative for them ultimately. So, yeah.
Okay. Let's see here. Oh, going on to another question here, Dr. Hoffman. This comes from Chris. For over a decade, I've been taking 10,000 units of vitamin D with no issues at all. Now, my recent blood work showed a vitamin D level.
So, context.
Yeah.
Because Chris is actually a frequent questioner here and participant.
Yes.
And he is an insulin-dependent diabetic.
Yes.
So from childhood, he's required, or, you know, adolescence, he's required insulin shots. Okay.
So a recent vitamin D level showed a blood level of 100. Now, his endocrinologist really encouraged him, as he says, begged him to cut the dose in half because he thought I was in danger of damaging my kidneys. So I went down to 5,000 units a day, and my most recent test showed that my vitamin D level is 75. Now, Chris says, oddly enough, I now require 60% more NPH insulin in the morning.
Wow.
Now, he says, I've read anecdotal reports on the internet of many diabetics claiming that they become less insulin sensitive when they lower their vitamin D on the advice of their endocrinologist. And nothing else has changed. My diet didn't change. My exercise didn't change. I haven't been ill. Nothing has changed except I lowered my dose from 10,000 units a day to 5,000. My blood level went from 100 to 75, and now suddenly I have to take 60% more NPH insulin in the morning.
Wow. So the question is whether to continue taking a dose of vitamin D that causes your vitamin D levels to be at the borderline of potential toxicity, almost using vitamin D pharmacologically, because 10,000 international units per day is, you know, about what you make if you're a lifeguard, you know, every day during the summer, you know, that your body can make that. But does every person deserve that amount of vitamin D? And would some people experience problems like kidney stones with more than, you know, 100? So, you know, this is what I would say, is that diabetics are at risk of kidney disease and kidney deterioration. But the kind of kidney problems they have are not the kind of kidney problems that vitamin D causes. Vitamin D will cause the potential for calcium stones because of hypercalcemia. You know, too much vitamin D can cause too much calcium to be absorbed and high levels of calcium in the blood, which then ultimately get deposited in the kidneys. So I would say this is a bit of a lesser concern, especially if he's had a track record of taking 10,000 and he's never had a kidney stone. Now, at the first instigation that he were to have a kidney stone, or even if he were to be found to have the presence of calcium oxalate crystals in his urine, I would back off of the high dose of vitamin D. But I don't really see it as a problem, other than a hypothetical problem, not a real problem. Now, the question is it bad to take more insulin? Well, it is bad to take more insulin, especially if you're type 2 diabetic and you're taking a lot of insulin. It's just going to keep you fat. Yes. And it's going to result in, you know, the deposition of adipose storage. And, you know, because look, what happens to a diabetic who doesn't take insulin? A type 1 diabetic, they actually waste away. They become, you know, like concentration camp victims. There's pictures of children who used to be diabetic and they would basically die of, in effect, starvation, because it was like sugar, sugar everywhere, but not a drop to drink. All the sugar was in their blood and it wouldn't get into their cells.
Into their cells. Yeah,
that's what insulin does. So, okay, so I guess... What do you think, Layla? Could an argument be made that, you know, this is maybe bad to take more insulin? Because, you know, insulin...
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have to agree with what Chris is saying, because he says, I'm thinking that needing more insulin will make my cells more insulin resistant, and that cannot be a good thing. On the other hand, his endocrinologist favors more insulin over more vitamin D.
Well, endocrinologists focus, conventional endocrinologists are more about control. And they're very liberal with insulin, whereas in the holistic management of diabetes, both type 1 and type 2, we really want to kind of minimize the insulin. So, for example, Dr. Bernstein, Dr. Dick Bernstein, who I went to med school with, he's like a, you know, very low-carb type 1 diabetic. He was type 1 diabetic in med school, and he would be on a very, very keto diet or Atkins type diet at the time, very low carb. And he was all for managing his diabetes with the lowest amount of insulin possible. But to do that, he had to exercise a ton and eat, you know, a lot of protein and no carbs and, you know, fat as a source of fuel.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess, you know, I'm not in a position to countermand the endocrinologist. I actually think that it's
you know,
a little bit like an argument like the devil in the deep blue sea. You know, on the one hand this, on the one hand that. I'm just not sure that ultimately it's going to make that much of a difference for as conscientious diabetic as Chris is. And, you know, with all the healthful things that he's doing, I think it is important for him to keep his blood sugar. I mean, obviously, for type 1 diabetic, keeping blood sugar low is important. And yes, to have a hemoglobin A1C that's, you know, 7.2 or less is really going to help all the organs, the brain, the heart, the kidneys. I mean, more of a problem for the kidneys that hemoglobin A1C should go up. That's the that's what's going to damage the kidneys in the long run.
Absolutely. Dr. Hoplin, you know what I would like to see? You know, we were told that this blood level of vitamin D at 100 may be a problem. I'm willing to bet a little bit, if I was a gambler, which I'm not, maybe we could go to 120 without much consequence. Other scenarios.
It's a little arbitrary.
Scenarios where, exactly,
yeah,
where some doctors have seen, oh, I like it closer to 100 because then these particular symptoms are gone or that gets better. So I'm wondering if we need to kind of change the range a little bit.
Well, you know, I agree, but I think that in situations where the vitamin D is being used therapeutically for a disease purpose, for an ordinary person, you know, I'm not sure you need to push your vitamin D to 100.
Right.
And for a person who's using it therapeutically, say, for example, a person who's using it for like multiple sclerosis, there's evidence that really high doses of vitamin D help to slow the progression of that particular, of many autoimmune diseases, but in particular, multiple sclerosis. And the doses that have been used in some studies are as high as 14,000 international units per day. And there you have to very carefully watch levels. But in the case of someone with a disease where their brain is literally being damaged by an autoimmune attack, it seems that the lesser of the evils is to court a high amount of vitamin D than brain deterioration, you know? So that's where I think a more nuanced approach would be good, as you suggest. You know, that, you know, for the ordinary person, like, don't let your vitamin D go over 100, you know, because, you know, you don't need to do, you know, you don't have an autoimmune disease. You don't have psoriasis, another condition where high doses of vitamin D might be helpful. You know?
Yeah. So Chris is wondering what to do. And, you know, I think it merits more study on what the vitamin D level, maybe we need to look more closely at ranges. Oh, at one point, is it of any consequence? And all of the above. You know?
Well, it is weighing the risk of taking more insulin versus the risk of courting the renal toxicity of vitamin D, which I think, you know, I've seen patients who have, you know, look, people get a little carried away and they take too much vitamin D. We've seen a lot of people who have elevated vitamin D and we tell them to cut it back, but we haven't seen those people being very symptomatic. And, you know, I remember well a case where I saw a person who had been taking 50,000 international units of vitamin D every weekday, a young man, for a long period of time during COVID because he thought that vitamin D was going to protect him from COVID. And we looked at everything, you know, I was thinking like, oh my goodness, your vitamin D levels are astronomical. And they were like well into the hundreds. And, but he had no consequences. He had no renal toxicity. I mean, maybe he was young and he dodged a bullet. I'm not saying that we shouldn't pay attention to that 100 speed limit for vitamin D.
Sure.
But, you know, I think your point is well taken, is that there is a certain arbitrariness to setting that as the upper limits.
Yeah.
It just requires more study, I think.
It does. It really, really does. So Chris is in quite a quandary, but hey, thank you for sending this very, very thoughtful question.
Yeah.
Wow.
Good stuff. Right. We're going to divide our podcast into two parts. And
oh, my goodness.
In part two, give us a preview of what we're going to tackle.
I'm a 74-year-old woman not taking medications, but I have bronchiectasis. Should I take the pneumonia vaccine and the RSV vaccine?
Okay. Good question. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman on a particularly active siren night here in Manhattan.
Yes.
Nothing bad is happening. But you may hear that in the background from time to time. Because I live near what's called Bedpan Alley, which is the stretch that extends. It's actually where I did my residency. I did my residency on Bedpan Alley because there's three hospitals that line up. On 23rd Street, you've got Manhattan VA, and on 25th or 26th, you've got Bellevue, and then a little further uptown, you've got NYU. So I was all up and down Bedpan Alley doing my medical training way back when. And then there's more hospitals. There's Mount Sinai, and then there's all kinds of things. There's Cornell.
Lenox Hill.
Yeah.
New York Presbyterian. Oh, yeah. You're right in the middle of all that.
Yep. That's where I am. Okay. When we return, more of today's Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.